You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 25th of November 2020 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I'm Emma Nelson and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up, did Carrie Lam keep Hong Kongers happy with her annual address? With a pandemic-weary population, the resignation of opposition lawmakers and Beijing to keep on side. Our correspondent in the city will assess whether she pulled it off. Also ahead, with Donald Trump accepting the transition should begin for President-elect Joe Biden, we look at the people who play key roles in the new administration.
Expect that experience to be invaluable as the UN and other international agencies look to coordinate the international response to the coronavirus pandemic.
Plus, we find out more about Taiwan starting work on a submarine and the trial of Nicolas Sarkozy, facing corruption charges and arguing with the judge in the process. Plus, the newspapers and the latest climate change news and why 12 restaurants in Helsinki are teaming up to save the city's food life. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. Before we begin, a quick look at what else is happening in today's news. The US President-elect Joe Biden says the contact from the current White House administration in terms of the transition has been sincere. Russia has accused a US destroyer of entering its territorial waters in the Sea of Japan. And Angela Merkel will meet Germany's regional leaders later to propose a further tightening of the country's coronavirus restrictions, while in France, it is emerging from its lockdown this weekend. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on these stories. But first, there had been huge expectations placed on Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, ahead of her annual address. Her city's residents are weary of the pandemic. Financial and business communities are eager to hear of a financial recovery plan. Opposition lawmakers resigned en masse this month, and Beijing must be kept happy too. So to find out whether she said what was needed, let's hear now from James Chambers, Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief. He joins me now. Welcome back, James.
Hi, Emma.
So what did she say?
Well, as you quite rightly said, there were huge expectations leading up to this policy address because Carrie Lam, the chief executive, had postponed it by a month so she could go up to mainland China and have some talks with the senior Communist Party leaders in Beijing and with the provincial leaders in neighbouring Guangdong and hopefully bring back some kind of exciting and important economic measures and initiatives to get Hong Kong going again. What I would say from the start, it was a huge speech. She spoke for some 2 hours, which is more than double the length of her usual policy addresses. And I guess it has been a personal victory for Carrie Lam in some respects, because it's been the first policy address that she managed to deliver without any interruption. Usually when she delivers these speeches at the legislative chamber in front of lawmakers, the opposition pan-democrats normally try and disrupt her. And it got so bad last year that she actually had to give up her speech and go ahead and deliver it via video. So the fact that she was able to stand up in front of lawmakers this year and go on for over 2 hours, I guess she'll be quite happy with that. But as you said, it's because there are no opposition lawmakers in LegCo these days. So she is able to kind of rattle on for all that time without any fear of interruption. You know, whether she delivered on her promises to bring back some big news from mainland China, I seriously doubt it. I mean, the only big news or initiative that I seem to get out of listening to it is that Beijing might set aside some of their COVID-19 vaccines for Hong Kongers if necessary. And there's not going to be many people here thrilled to hear that. But she did have plenty to say. She did have plenty to announce. There were some 200 initiatives. And, you know, outside of all the stuff about, you know, national security and the rule of law and the constitution, you know, her objective here was to try and get Hong Kong going again, to get Hong Kong out of the current impasse. You know, the theme of her speech was striving ahead with renewed perseverance. She's talked about rebuilding Hong Kong, rebuilding trust. So I guess her objective here is to kind of draw a line under the last 18 months and try and, you know, press go on Hong Kong's recovery.
So much of this recovery depends on Beijing's support, doesn't it?
It does, because, you know, the mainland economy is the most important market for Hong Kong. And at the moment, you know, Hong Kong, the border to mainland is shut, or is effectively shut. And so, you know, when Carrie Lam went to Beijing, when she left Hong Kong, she said her primary objective was to, you know, convince the mainland authorities to reopen the border, so you know, business could restart. But you know, she was given a bit of a dressing down in Beijing. They kind of told her to go home, go back to Hong Kong, and sort out COVID-19 before even thinking about opening the border. So she came back a bit sheepish, without any good news to deliver. So perhaps we were looking to this speech to see if actually she had achieved much during her trip. She did say that the feedback she had from her meetings in China was very, very positive, and the central government fully supports the long-term development of Hong Kong. But there was not much concrete measures in there to give people any hope. I guess the twin visions, she announced these two visions. One is the vision for 2030 for the rule of law, which is about spending the next 10 years and hundreds of millions of Hong Kong dollars educating kids and the youth about a proper understanding of what the rule of law means and how to be law-abiding citizens. She kept using the term educating, which makes it sound less sinister. But I imagine there'll be a lot of parents in Hong Kong a bit worried right now about what that actually means. Her second one was about this Lam Tau Tomorrow vision, which is this huge plan to build an entire new island in Hong Kong. If it goes ahead, it would be the biggest infrastructure project ever conceived here. And it's to build a new island so that the government can build new homes and try and solve once and for all Hong Kong's housing problem. You know, Beijing says that the housing and livelihood issues, or the lack of housing, is at the root cause of all, you know, the social unrest in Hong Kong. And Carrie Lam clearly sees it as her job to try and solve this. So she's basically said that she's going to push ahead with that. The whole process is taking too long for her liking. And she sees it very much as her government's role to get that moving again. So, I mean, that is a massive project for Hong Kong. And it could indeed, you know, solve a lot of the housing issues here. But the two very much go hand in hand. You have the rule of law aspect, or the lack of rule of law, or the, you know, the events of last year when all of these kids were on the streets and are now in the courts getting prosecuted for breaching national security. And then on the other side, the problem that the young people have in they don't feel that they have a future in Hong Kong, because they can't buy a house, because they can't, you know, invest in their home city.
James, tell us a little bit more about the national security policy. The fact is that as she is talking about educating future generations of Hong Kongers, that's clearly a message to young Hong Kongers and also to the outside world that the city will take a direction now which sharply follows Beijing.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it was very noticeable that she was wearing a pin badge today with a China and Hong Kong flag on it. It's the first time I've seen her wear that pin badge delivering these policy addresses. So it's very clear that, Hong Kong's future is closely entwined with that of mainland China. And a lot of her speech was about, how Hong Kong's future, how Hong Kong's economic prosperity, and how, the careers of Hong Kong youth lie on the mainland. You know, she was talking about how Hong Kong needs to be more closely integrated with China, and how Hong Kong should sit at the heart of the Greater Bay Area, which is this big Beijing-backed project to bring 9 cities in southern China together. To rival some places like Silicon Valley. So, this speech was all about how, Hong Kong's future lies, with China, and how she wants to, I guess, help, encourage, promote, and educate the Hong Kong youth of today and tomorrow that, to get on in this city and to get ahead, they need to be prepared to find a career in China.
James, finally, the purpose of these speeches have rather altered somewhat in the last couple of years, haven't they? I mean, there used to be the opportunity to lay out vision of governance and unveil major policy initiatives, which is arguably what Carrie Lam has done today. But one of the main questions that needed to be answered here was, has she actually succeeded in soothing all those people, the people whose economic outlook was damaged, the people who are weary of the pandemic, those who are worried about the opposition resigning? Do you think Carrie Lam will succeed in keeping things under control because of this speech?
I think from this speech, it was very clear that she has completely avoided, the elephant in the room, which is the political crisis in Hong Kong and the yearning that the Hong Kong people have, for democracy. What was interesting about Carrie Lam, that when she became chief executive in 2017, she spent her first 2 policy addresses, focusing on Hong Kong's long-term issues, which are, housing and a lack of land for development. And she's very solid on those topics. She was a very successful secretary for development. And you can see that she kind of enjoys talking about those things. But she, she had initial success because she avoided politics. She avoided speaking about the democracy movement and all those kind of latent problems that Hong Kong has. I mean, and then last year, that was when she waded into this messy affair by bringing in this bill, this fugitive bill, and then all hell broke loose. So in a way, this year, she's kind of going back to more solid ground and ground she's more familiar with by talking a lot about, housing, land and development again. There is nothing in this speech that shows any kind of roadmap for how, Hong Kong's political problems might get back on track. There was not much on the yearning for democracy and for electing lawmakers and for eventually electing the chief executive. She kind of ducked all those difficult conversations and basically said that Hong Kong is an executive-led government. People need to respect the rule of law, and she's going to spend a lot of time educating people about national security. So there's going to be a lot of people who are very unsatisfied by this, especially among the political opposition. And as you said, on the business side, there weren't any grand reveals. There wasn't anything that will give people confidence in the next few years. There was nothing coming from mainland China that will surprise people or inspire people.
James Chambers in Hong Kong, thank you for joining us on The Globalist. Taiwanese shipbuilders have begun work on the country's first domestically produced submarine. Taipei wants to make it clear that it's ready for any military offensive from China. Well, to tell us more, I'm joined by Alessio Patalano, who's professor at King's College London and an expert on Asian defence. Welcome, Alessio.
Good morning, Emma.
So tell us what they're doing.
Well, this is quite an unprecedented piece of news. I mean, the Taiwanese have been working on the development of a domestic submarine program for quite some time. But of course, as you can imagine, submarines are extremely complex platform to build. They require a skilled labor force and engineering capabilities of quite considerable level. And so it took quite some time to the Taiwanese to harness that kind of expertise, consulting international specialists, certainly in the United States, but in also in countries like Japan, even here in the UK. So today, the announcement sort of tells us something very important that has a significance at three different levels. The first and most important one is the political signaling, the commitment that President Tsai has had ever since she became president, that she renewed when she was confirmed earlier this year, about the fact that she wants China to take Taiwan on equal terms, to have a conversation about the stability in the Straits of Taiwan, in a position of weakness. And this submarines are very important in maintaining an asymmetric posture in the Straits of Taiwan, making difficult any plan to take over the island. So politically, it's a very important statement, particularly because 60% of this design will be made in Taiwan, will be sort of all coming from home, the rest are from external support.
So tell us a little bit about how long this has been in the making, because work building on a submarine doesn't just happen overnight, does it? There's been some planning, clearly.
No, absolutely, Emma. You're absolutely right. And in particular, the striking thing about this is that Taiwan still maintains four submarines. They are very old. They're some of the oldest submarines on the planet. So in that sense, it's a most legitimate question. And because of the sensitive nature of this type of platform, of course, it's always been one that was not within any sort of arms sales agreement with anybody, nor it could be. So the domestic option was really the only option. And over the years, you know, even though the shipbuilding capacity in Taiwan is very much sort of the highest possible standards, at the same time, having very high standards of quality of shipbuilding, it doesn't necessarily mean that you can put together a submarine. So we know, for example, that over the years, there has been sort of constant reach out to countries with very advanced submarine programs, like Japan. The reported news suggests that the design, in fact, will be based on the Soryu class used in Japan for their own domestic submarines, suggesting that, and from an engineering perspective, particularly in the ship design, there was some involvement of the Japanese sector, which would be quite a sensible thing to do because it is one of the places in the world where submarines are built from scratch, completely at home, based on their own technology. So that kind of advice probably played an important role. So a long thing in the making, but if she made the announcement, it also means that they feel the confidence that they reached the stage where they can make it happen. And the timeline suggests that the program will be put together quite quickly.
And the US is involved in some respect, isn't it?
Of course. I mean, you know, when it comes to the question of Taiwan's development in terms of combat capabilities, the US is very important because it's been a significant supplier, together with other countries like France, in terms of key technologies for advanced equipment. And as you probably very well know, just a few days ago, news was released about a one-star level admiral, the responsible for all intelligence and Indo-Pacific command. These are sort of little signals that indicates the importance of the proximity of partners like the United States, not only in the technical know-how, but also in the sort of experience of how, in practical terms, these capabilities make the difference when it comes to national defense. So in this respect, the United States is absolutely a critical player to understand where Japan is. And the last last 4 years under the Trump administration, this is one of the interesting developments. There has been like a clear openness to talk about stronger ties with Taiwan.
Finally, there's some news breaking from the Sea of Japan from the last couple of days. Russia has accused a US destroyer of entering its territorial waters. And Moscow says one of its warships, I think it was a USS John S. McCain, that was caught a mile inside its maritime border. And Russia said that it threatened to ram the ship. What's happening here, Alessio?
Oh, I mean, this is a part of, you know, people tend to forget that people associate FONOPS with the South China Sea. And that is a part of the unfortunate sort of elements of this story of the past few years. The FONOP program goes back from before UNCLOS was adopted. It is something that U.S. government started and applies everywhere in the world, where countries make excessive maritime claims that are inconsistent with either international law as it became sort of crystallized in UNCLOS, or established norms around the application of law of the sea. And this is a classic case whereby the Russians apply in a very sort of liberal fashion their definition for gulfs and around Vladivostok, and the United States just challenged that. And they did that, I think, very much in part to remind, particularly in their part of the world, that FONOPs are not something that you do to tell something to the Chinese, but actually you do it, more importantly, to make a point about the importance of respecting the practices and the established understanding of the norms and principles of international law.
Alessio Patilano, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. Still to come on today's Globalist, we take a closer look at the makeup of Joe Biden's cabinet, and we go through the newspapers too, and we find out while Helsinki wants to collaborate among its restaurateurs to save the food industry. That's all to come.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
US President-elect Joe Biden has unveiled the first members of his foreign policy team, who he hopes will take office with him in January next year. The experienced team includes many names from the Obama administration, under which Biden was vice president, and it marks a sharp departure from the administration of Donald Trump. Monocle's news editor Chris Chermak took a closer look at the nominees.
Joe Biden and his transition team have been waiting patiently for the Trump administration to clear the path this week for a formal transition of power. Now that the transition can officially begin, the president-elect yesterday got down to the business of unveiling key members of the team he intends to rely on for counsel when he takes office in January.
It's a team that will keep our country and our people safe and secure. It's a team that reflects the fact that America is back, ready to lead the world, not retreat from it, once again sit at the head of the table, ready to confront our adversaries and not reject our allies, ready to stand up for our values.
Of the names unveiled so far, a few things have been clear. First is that Joe Biden is planning a sharp departure from the policies of the last 4 years, returning to a more traditional multilateralist approach, nominating many of the officials who roamed the streets of the U.S. Capitol under Barack Obama. During the campaign, Biden also pledged to nominate a candidate that looked like America, and he's delivering on that promise too. Picking Alejandro Mayorkas as the first Latino to head the Department of Homeland Security, Avril Haines as the first female director of National Intelligence, and Linda Thomas-Greenfield, an African-American, as UN ambassador. It's Anthony Blinken who gets perhaps the most high-profile post in the first batch of cabinet members unveiled yesterday.
He will be the Secretary of State who previously served in top roles on Capitol Hill, in the White House, and in the State Department. He delivered for the American people in each place.
A longtime Biden advisor and Deputy Secretary of State under Obama, Blinken spent his formative teenage years growing up in Paris. He speaks fluent French, and aside from being an accomplished musician, is also known to be a passionate and avowed pro-European. It's a nomination that signals Europe and NATO are likely to once again take center stage as an ally in American diplomacy over the next 4 years. But though Blinken might get the biggest post, he's hardly the biggest name in Biden's foreign policy team. That would probably be John Kerry, the former Secretary of State under Obama and himself a 2004 presidential candidate.
For the first time ever, there will be a principal on the National Security Council who can make sure climate change is on the agenda in the Situation Room. For the first time ever, we will have a presidential envoy on climate.
Kerry will take on a special role as climate envoy. It's a clear signal that Biden intends to reverse course on climate change, something that's also characterized by his promised return to the Paris Climate Accords, which Kerry himself helped negotiate. Expect John Kerry to reassert U.S. leadership in the global climate debate, which will take on new urgency next year with another climate summit planned in Glasgow. Though Kerry might be the biggest name and Blinken the musician, neither is the owner of the most intriguing resume. That honor goes to Avril Haines, the likely new director of national intelligence.
To lead our intelligence community, I didn't pick a politician or a political figure. I picked a professional. She's eminently qualified.
Not only is Haines a respected mainstay of the intelligence community and the first woman to become deputy CIA director under Obama, Haines is also a former pilot, auto mechanic, bookstore owner, physicist, and brown belt in judo. But perhaps most relevant is her work in international law and human rights, a noted background for an intelligence community that has been known to skirt international law in the past. Next up, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, Biden's pick to be ambassador to the United Nations. She might get the award for the most varied diplomatic postings.
A seasoned and distinguished diplomat with 35 years in the Foreign Service who never forgot where she came from, growing up in segregated Louisiana.
Thomas-Greenfield has held diplomatic posts in Switzerland, Pakistan, Kenya, the Gambia, Nigeria, Jamaica, before becoming ambassador to Liberia in the last decade. After that, she returned to Washington to head up Obama's Africa policy in the latter half of his administration, including during the Ebola crisis. Expect that experience to be invaluable as the UN and other international agencies look to coordinate the international response to the coronavirus pandemic. And last but not least, perhaps the clearest indication of a policy shift falls to Alejandro Mayorkas, who will become the first Latino to head the Department of Homeland Security.
This is one of the hardest jobs in government. The DHS secretary needs to keep us safe from threats at home and from abroad. And it's the job that plays a critical role in fixing our broken immigration system.
Mayorkas is a Cuban-American whose parents emigrated to Los Angeles when he was a child. He made a career for himself in law enforcement, becoming the former top federal prosecutor in Los Angeles, before switching to Washington, where he served as the deputy secretary of the department he will now lead. Among his key roles in that last post was the implementation of what has become known as DACA, a program that blocks the deportation of children who were brought to the United States illegally by their parents. Expect Mayorkas' nomination to mark a clear shift in U.S. immigration policy. That's just one of the many dramatic changes in direction to be expected under Joe Biden's new cabinet. Before that can happen, Biden's nominees will have to be confirmed by the U.S. Senate, which could well remain in the hands of Trump's Republican Party. Some Republicans have already signaled some opposition to the nominees and shift in tone, with Senator Mark Rubio calling them caretakers of American decline and saying he has no interest in a return to the normal that left the U.S. dependent on China. Biden's team may have deep foreign policy experience, but that's no guarantee that all of them will be left standing when Biden enters office in January.
And my thanks to our news editor, Chris Chermak, for that report. You're listening to The Globalist live on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. In a moment, the latest on the trial of Nicolas Sarkozy. But first, with the time just nudging 7:30 a.m. here in London, a quick summary of the day's news headlines. The US President-elect Joe Biden says the contact from the current White House administration has been sincere. In an interview, he says work to start the formal transition process has not been begrudging so far. Donald Trump still refuses to admit defeat, although he has agreed to allow the formal transition process to begin. Russia has accused a US destroyer of entering its territorial waters in the Sea of Japan. Moscow says one of its warships caught the USS John S. McCain a mile inside its maritime border. It says it threatened to ram the ship. The US Navy denies wrongdoing and says it was not expelled. And Angela Merkel will meet Germany's regional leaders later to propose a further tightening of the country's coronavirus restrictions. While the Chancellor wants to restrict the number of people in shops and place extra measures in schools, many of the 16 state leaders want measures to be more relaxed. Whereas France is to emerge from its lockdown this weekend with shops reopening and the promise of people being able to see their families. The President, Emmanuel Macron, says bars and restaurants, however, will close until late January. And those are the headlines on The Globalist. This week, Nicolas Sarkozy became France's first post-war former president to stand trial on corruption charges. Monsieur Sarkozy is accused of trying to bribe a magistrate, and his stance in court was a combative one, answering back to the judge when his full name was read out. Well, Agnès Poirier is a journalist and author of the book Notre Dame, The Soul of France. I'm delighted to say she joins me on the line from Paris. Good morning, Agnès.
Good morning.
Just remind us of the charges that Monsieur Sarkozy faces, please.
Well, it's a long story. I think we should go back, otherwise we won't understand anything. There are many cases and several investigations against the former French president. Well, this one in particular emerged strangely when in 2013, that is to say a year after he left the Élysée Palace, French detectives were monitoring, in other words, listening to his conversations and communications with his lawyer. And they were at the time investigating how allegedly Nicolas Sarkozy received some illicit campaign funding, about 50 million euros, from the late Libyan leader Gaddafi. But while they were listening to his phones, they discovered something completely different, which was a conversation between a magistrate, a very senior magistrate, and Nicolas Sarkozy's lawyer. And the topic was for the magistrate to hand over some secret information about another case, which has since been dropped. So this is the first case and first investigation that is facing court for this week.
And he took a typical, what one describes, Sarkozy stance when he was in the dock and he was asked to talk about his full name. There is a sense that he is rather defiant when it comes to this process.
Oh yes, he's very much still the man we knew as a president, between 2007 and 2012. Is 65, but in great shape, very fit, very feisty, very pugnacious, and he told French television that he would be very combative, and you can rely on him for being so. But he's facing a few different cases. There's another one next year called the Big Malian Affair, and it's about overspending on his 2012 re-election bid. So he's going to be a very busy man. Interestingly, he said that all these affairs were, and I quote, an insult to his intelligence. We shall see. But what is interesting is that, the French justice system is not what it used to be decades ago, when no French president really would have faced anything, any charges in court. That time is over. And he's not the first president actually to face court. Jacques Chirac was tried and found guilty, but he didn't appear in court because at that time he was too ill with dementia. So He is the first, Nicolas Sarkozy is the first president, if you'd like, to appear physically in court, but not the first one to be charged.
What does it mean to France and the role of the president to see someone like Monsieur Sarkozy not facing one but several legal actions against him? And you mentioned Jacques Chirac, but these were not charges of corruption that Monsieur Chirac faced. These are thoughts. What Monsieur Sarkozy faces now really strikes at the heart of the reputation of the presidency, surely.
Yes, but again, it's very much a lot of the cases are to do with how you fund and finance a presidential campaign. The charges of corruption are more about influence peddling. You could trying to bribe a judge. Of course, that's corruption, and that's extremely important. Of course, but the French are now used to seeing, and that's a good thing, to seeing even their president having to explain themselves, which wasn't the case before. When I grew up in the 80s, you would never dream of seeing a French president in court. That has changed, and that transparency is something that we should rejoice about.
And Monsieur Sarkozy himself now sits on the boards of several big companies and has already hinted at a possible comeback to politics if there's no candidate to successfully try and take on Emmanuel Macron in the next presidential election. What do you think this is doing for his chances?
Well, I think he's also said that he was, and Carla Bruni, his wife, also said together only a few weeks ago that he wasn't thinking about making a political comeback. So I think a lot of people on the right, his former party, would like him to come back simply because they don't have any candidate, and the next presidential elections are taking place in only 2 years. But it looks unlikely that he will make a comeback, because unless he's proved innocent on every single case. But still, the French will be reluctant, I think, to have him back.
Agnès Poirier, as ever, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You're with The Globalist. Let's now have a look at the newspapers. To help us do that this morning is Terry Stiasny, who's a political journalist and author. Welcome back, Terry. Good to have you.
Good morning.
Where would you like to begin?
I'm afraid I'm not bringing sort of glad tidings of great joy as everybody is looking ahead to Christmas. But so let's start with the most a little bit depressing story from The Guardian, but they have an interesting exclusive. And the headline here reads, "The UK facing risk of systemic economic crisis," an official paper says. And this is, The Guardian has a leak of a Cabinet Office briefing paper, which warns about, as if this year hasn't been bad enough, it warns about all the terrible things that could possibly befall us towards the end of the year and the beginning of next. And it's important to say, these are the kinds of briefing papers that are prepared in government, and the job of people like this in the Cabinet Office is to look at a worst case scenario, and they do say that these are reasonable worst case scenarios according to the government. But the descriptions of what could potentially happen are really quite worrying. So it says that there's a notable risk that in coming months the country could face a perfect storm of simultaneous disasters, which could see, it says, winter 2020 could see a combination of severe flooding, pandemic influenza, a novel emerging infectious disease, I presume that's on top of the one we have already, and coordinated industrial action against a backdrop of the end of the Brexit transition period.
Right.
So these, so that's something to look forward to.
Our to-do list grows. What is the paper suggesting can be done about any of this?
Well, I mean, it is interesting. It is just shows that the kind of things that people in government do have to worry about. So one of the things that they're concerned about is food supply chains, which they worry about the circumstances which concurrently at the end of the year, saying there won't be overall food shortages, but problems could reduce availability of fresh supplies and push up prices. So there are worries about food insecurity. There's worries about community tensions and public order. Interestingly, some of the things you think are, you know, you wouldn't realise that, but once you think it through, you understand why. So there are worries in the civil service apparently about social care, particularly because of potential labour shortages caused by Brexit, because of reliance on care workers. And interestingly, I think, you know, this obviously comes against a background. We will see the Chancellor stand up today in the House of Commons and promise in his spending review money to try to save jobs and to try to save employment. And, you know, you realise that if people in government are reading documents like this, the kind of worries that they would have. But I think one of the things that is worrying is that saying that across many sectors, companies are fragile and this will have an impact on businesses. And also local councils are fragile, and saying that there's this lack of capacity among both government and businesses to actually cope with any more hits to them what's going on already.
There is a sense that the problems are not only multifaceted but far-reaching and touch every aspect of British society. So there will be a certain amount of homework to be done there. Let us have a look at the way that the European Union and countries just about to leave the transition period are dealing with the question of COVID. We've heard in the news headlines that Angela Merkel will have a sticky meeting today with her regional leaders who want to loosen regulations. She wants to tighten them. France wants to is going to loosen them this weekend. In England, right across the United Kingdom, we can have three families get together for 5 days and then back to square one again. Just run us through the way that different countries are approaching these, the imminent issue of Christmas, and why they all seem so different.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, particularly as you point out, Germany. I mean, we've talked about, I think it was last week we spoke about the fact that Angela Merkel had tried to reach an agreement with the German lender and hadn't at that point managed to, because the lender felt very much that they'd been bounced into coming up with a new plan. Now, they're now trying again, and a couple of German newspapers are reporting again on how they seem to have sort of, you know, rolled the ground a bit better this time. And so they have agreed a sort of a paper setting out these are the rules that are being proposed, and they've sort of had an exchange of views before this big meeting in Germany today. And it comes against the background of the German papers mostly pointing out that actually deaths from COVID in Germany have gone up at the moment, and they are still in Germany much more worried about that this is still going in the wrong direction. But they are talking about having slight easing over the Christmas period. So they're saying, but it will become at the cost of less meeting up before. So until the 20th of December in Germany, you will only be allowed to meet up to 5 people, which doesn't include numbers of children under 14. But they're saying between the 23rd of December and the 1st of January, you would be able to meet up to 10 people. So still having really quite a lot of restrictions. And there's all sorts of questions. You know, one of the main questions for all countries looking at this is how do you manage a movement of lots of people across your country or potentially into other countries? Because, of course, you know, it's a time of year when people want to go and visit relatives in one part of the country or another, visit different parts of the family. So in France, you know, Macron is being a little bit more optimistic. He's saying that, okay, you know, we're over the worst of the second peak, that the case numbers are starting to go down. And he's got a 3-stage plan for his sort of plan, which is that he's calling not a deconfinement, it's just a relaxing of the rules. So although people in France are very concerned that they've now breached the number of 50,000 deaths linked to coronavirus, he is firstly saying that small businesses will be able to reopen this weekend, because there's been a lot of concern, particularly from, you know, the owners of small businesses, saying that in the run-up to Christmas they are, you know, losing their money. So, you know, particularly in France, people have been worried about hairdressers, they have been worried about their bookshops, and they will be allowed to reopen from this weekend onwards. But however, restaurants and bars in France and And ski resorts will not be able to reopen until the third stage of this relaxation, which is not planned to come into force until the 20th of January. So you will be able to go to a cinema and theatre and a museum in France after the 15th. People will also be allowed to travel within between different regions of France, which they haven't been able to do up to now. You're only supposed to go a kilometre from your home. But some of these restrictions, you know, really talking far into January. And when you look at the times in the UK, we're sort of going to have a complicated set of restrictions so that you'll be allowed to meet members of up to three households, but only during a fixed period between the 23rd of December and the 27th of December. But again, looking at the problems people are pointing out, they say the Transport Secretary has, according to the Times, urged people to consider avoiding travelling by railway, which, you know, does make it difficult for, particularly if you want to travel to visit family in a distant part of the country, and if you don't have access to a car. So again, this is, none of this is going to be easy, and I don't think anyone is suggesting that it is.
Terry Stiassny, as ever, thank you so much for bringing us a newspaper review, a very comprehensive one, as it is today on The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time now to join Akshat Rathi, who's a climate and energy reporter for Bloomberg News, for the latest climate change business news. Welcome back, Akshat.
Good morning.
We want to start with Arctic drilling, something that was rather popular about a year ago, but now, given the transition period at the White House, not so much interest anymore. Is that right?
That's right. And the Trump administration is racing to try and get as many leases out to oil companies in the Arctic region, in Alaska, as soon as it can. And it turns out, because of the requirements, the earliest it can have an auction on those leases is January 19th, which is a day before Joe Biden is to be sworn in as president. But it's not just the fact that there are legal wrangles to be met with this deadline, but there's also a real clear sense that the companies that are going to bid for these leases are going to struggle to raise the money that's going to be needed to drill in this hostile region, which is crucial for nature, but also is producing oil that we likely don't need.
Is this a sea change in terms of the way that people are thinking about long-term investment? Or is this just a realization, actually, almost, that anything to do with the Trump administration carries some toxicity with it?
It's a combination of factors here. I mean, the first and foremost on investors' mind would be the fact that drilling for oil in that region requires you to have a break-even price of $80 a barrel, which we've not reached since October 2018. And the glut in the market right now means it'll be some while before we reach there. But also, there have been mandates that banks have put out where they are banning certain types of financing. So coal financing in much of the world, much of the banks have stopped. There are very many banks in the U.S. that are that have said very clearly they will not be financing Arctic drilling. And there's also the fact that 70% of American voters don't want this.
So tell us a little bit more about what could actually happen with this one. I mean, are there going to be other nations that will jump in to try and get Arctic drilling, or is this just something that is something that the Americans are going to have to be steering away from?
Right. I mean, this thing is in Alaska, so that's an American region, and the U.S. presidency currently has control over it. But you're right. I mean, Arctic drilling in general is becoming very difficult. So most recently, there's a case in Norway currently with people trying to demand that government has given leases in the Arctic region that it should rescind them because it's not in the interest of the country or the planet.
Speaking of into the interest of the country or the planet, I think we saw a couple of years ago the queues of people trying to get up Mount Everest, which really brought home just how starkly people are just using Mount Everest as a sort of a play area. However, it is now being used as a lab.
Well, we think of Mount Everest as, of course, the highest peak on the planet, but as part of the Himalayan region, it is also the third pole, which is it has the most amount of ice after the North Pole and the South Pole. And it also, of course, that ice serves nearly 1.5 billion people on the planet. So what happens on Everest and around Everest matters a lot to people. There's also sort of a historical point which is curious and fascinating, that John Tyndall, the climate scientist from mid-19th century, was a mountaineer. And he, in 1859, became the first person to demonstrate that carbon dioxide is heating or has the ability to absorb heat and may eventually heat the planet by doing experiments during his mountaineering expeditions. So this expedition that has gone to Everest is sort of a way to try and send a group of scientists with very different areas of expertise to try and collaborate and tell the story of what is happening on Mount Everest, what climate change is doing to it, and what impacts will it have.
What's interesting about this is the fact that science is being taken out into the world as opposed to science being brought in. I mean, how much are people saying that this is going to change people's perspective as to the way that they work and the results that they find?
Well, scientists do go out. It's just that they likely don't go out in such large groups in an organized fashion when they end up publishing, you know, 15-odd papers in a journal tied to one theme. So that's the different thing about here. But you're right. I think the things that need to change are to understand the sheer impact that humans are having on places like Mount Everest. You know, the study shows that even the most remote parts has plastic fibers around it. It shows that, you know, ironically, because of global warming, there's likely to be a little more oxygen available at the highest peak, which may make climbing more easier, something we probably wouldn't have thought of. But crucially, it shows that glaciers are melting really rapidly, and that means bad for the people down valley who get water from it, but also people who live near the mountain because landslides are becoming more common.
Let's move finally to an astonishing story of the Communist Party bureaucrat in China who quietly changed the country's climate change policy. Tell us about him.
So the biggest piece of climate news probably of the decade came earlier this year when China declared that it's going to reach net zero emissions by 2060. China's, of course, the largest emitter on the planet. More than a quarter of all emissions come from China. And the fascinating thing is that everyone was taken by surprise. When President Xi Jinping spoke about this, much of the cadre of Communist Party across the country weren't expecting this to come through. And the man behind it is a veteran climate negotiator named Xie Zhenhua, who was famous initially in his early days defending the right for China and other developing countries to put out carbon dioxide because rich countries have done so. But he's also now turned around and said, China can lead and be the country that will cut emissions and create the industries that help us cut emissions.
Akshat Rathi from Bloomberg, thank you as ever for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to The Globalist.
We're changing the way we do subscriptions at Monocle, and there's never been a better time to sign up. We've just launched our first ever digital subscription. The new look Monocle Digital Editions offers improved access to the magazine on the go, at the touch of a button, and is rather dashing too. It also includes our extensive archive of global reporting and a growing roster of travel guides and tips. Whether you opt for print and digital or digital only, your subscription will include unlimited access to the Monocle Digital Editions. That goes for existing subscribers too. Head to monocle.com/subscribe to sign up.
Finally, remember when Copenhagen's food became a movement in itself? Now in Helsinki, restaurants are joining up with the aim of making the Finnish capital a world-class food city. Some of the city's most famous food names are involved in the movement. It's called, brilliantly, Raising Hell. And Ville Relander is a restaurateur and one of the founders of the project. And I'm delighted to say he joins me from the Finnish capital. Good morning, Ville.
Good morning from Helsinki. Thank you for the very kind words.
It is a delight to have you. Now tell us, what are you doing in Helsinki to save your food world?
We're working together now with 12 restaurateurs, and instead of competing, we've decided to cooperate. And we want to make sure that Helsinki comes out of this pandemic as energetic as before.
Tell us, how are you going to do this? How are you going to cooperate then?
Well, we have a little ambitious goal to get every Helsinkian. We're around 1 million people over here, and we want each and every one to purchase one gift voucher to a restaurant this Christmas. And even more important would be that all those companies that have canceled their traditional Christmas parties, that they would instead use that budget to get for their team members a gift voucher to a restaurant.
And how have you managed to sort of all come together? Because traditionally, restaurants don't like each other very much, do they? Because they don't like the fact that someone else's custom is going somewhere.
Yeah, well, it might be a little easier thanks to the pandemic and thanks to the fact that we're a smaller capital. And we all need each other, and we cannot anymore afford to compete with each other. We just need to help each other. And I was surprised to see that so many wanted to come on board. And 24 hours ago, we launched the whole campaign, and so many more restaurants are joining us now. It's not only for us 12 restaurateurs. Actually, every food restaurant in Helsinki can join. And I'm receiving so much support, not only from restaurateurs, even from companies. There was last night a one-man lorry company that contacted me and said that they would offer their lorry to communicate our message, their distilleries, their breweries. There's all kinds of people that want to support Helsinki and its restaurants.
Now, I mentioned a moment ago the fact that Copenhagen's food became a movement in itself. Are you hoping for the same thing for Helsinki, not just for local people to get a voucher at Christmas, but to maybe tell the rest of the world about the Helsinki food identity?
Well, I think every city in the world is looking up to Copenhagen, and it has given me personally very much. However, as humble as we might be here in Helsinki, time shows if Helsinki will be the new capital of culinary cool. I feel Copenhagen is at the moment maybe picking the fruits while we're still working a little harder here in Helsinki. And there's a really great energy in the restaurant scene at the moment. But it's great what we see in Copenhagen, how one city or how one restaurant can really change the image of a city.
So finally, Ville, I've got mere seconds to ask you this. I've arrived in Helsinki and you want to show me something and make me eat something which sums up the brilliance of Helsinki's food. What is it?
Oh, there would be so much to experience. I think the cool thing about Helsinki is that it's so approachable. It's so unpretentious, and it's made for the locals. And there is a very own personal style of doing things. We're not part of Scandinavia. We're not Russia. We're something in between, and we're a fairly young restaurant culture that is evolving all the time. And I think you can really sense the city while you sit down in one of the great establishments.
Finnish restaurateur Ville Relander, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. That's all we have time for today's programme. Many thanks to our producers Daniel Bache, Carlotta Ribello and Paige Reynolds, our researcher Charlie Filmer-Court and our studio manager Louis Allen. The headlines are on the way, and then the briefing is live at midday in London. The Globalist is back at the same time tomorrow. Hope you can join me for that. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.